And now, it's the Florida Spectacular Podcast, hosted by Kathy Celestri. Find Kathy on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Celestri, CathySalustri, on Facebook at Celestri Kathy, and visit her website, GreatFloridaRoadTrip.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to this week's edition of the Florida Spectacular. I'm your host, Kathy Celestri, and this week we have a frequent flyer guest returning to talk about one of his new projects. Brad Bertelli, who has written some snorkeling and snorkeling spot books about Florida and the Keys, and a wonderful fiction book, mostly fiction book, about the Florida Keys skunk ape, has left his post at a Keys museum, striking out on his own, and he started a Facebook group that has gotten a lot of attention lately. Brad, thanks for being here.
Kathy, thanks for having me on again. I've got my seatbelt buckled in, and I'm ready to take this flight.
Here we go. All right, well, get your tray in the
sticking with the
position.
Flame, yeah.
Here we go. I love having you on the podcast because it makes me feel like I'm almost in the Keys. And up here in Tampa Bay, it's sweater weather today and going to be rainy. So it's kind of a nice little 30-minute vacation I get.
Well, I'm glad I'm here to assist you in any way I can.
Well, and that's nice because I actually, long time ago, I made myself a promise I would get to the Keys every year because I went for a while. Where situation was, I couldn't get there, and I missed it. And the only year I've missed since I've done that is the year Irma hit, because we didn't go early enough in the year, and Irma ruined everything. So I make up for it. Some years I go two or three times, four times. And when I can't get there, I like to follow your brand new Facebook group, which fascinates me. Not because there's a Facebook group about Florida Keys, or specifically Florida Keys history, but the odd way it's grown so quickly over the past few weeks.
So let's
talk about that a little bit.
I am blown away every time, you know, every day it's more people. And I'm just blown away and humbled by how well it's been received. And thankful.
Well, I just remember one day we were texting and you texted me and you said, hey, what do you think it would be like if I started a, Facebook group about Keys history. I'm like, man, go for it. And of course, I was thinking there's got to be a ton of these. And maybe there isn't, because now you've got, what, 4,000, 40-something hundred people? How many people are in your group right now?
4,200 at the moment.
And the name of the group, incidentally, is Florida Keys History with Brad Bertelli, which I think is distinctive. But yeah, it's just a simple group. You post just a little old picture and some history, and you get not very many trolls, which I think is fantastic.
I don't know why. I've been monitoring it, so you can't post on it unless I approve.
Well, that would be why.
Yeah, so I take care of those because those are bothersome, I find.
Well, it makes me want to just go away from Facebook. But yes. I think it would be a shame because in addition to posting some of your columns that you write for Keys Weekly, you also have some beautiful old maps and some wonderful pictures from the Jerry Wilkinson collection, pictures you've taken. And it's almost like you're doing more history now than you were at the museum, which is odd because I know you created that museum from the ground up, but I just love seeing this page. It's like a little museum visit every day.
And that's what, you know, after I left that facility, I wasn't sure I wanted to, you know, be the history police, which I've kind of had become working with the museum and their Facebook page and kind of, you know, trying to correct everyone's history. And because there's so much bogus history out there and there's lots of history. There's a Florida Keys history Facebook page, which is why I added my name to mine. And, wasn't sure that I wanted to, you know, continue to, you know, try to put out as much great history as I possibly could and, you know, try to correct some of the inaccuracies that are constantly out there. But my old boss said, hey, why don't you do it? And I decided not to. So on Christmas Eve day, I decided and I think I texted you on Christmas Eve day or the 23rd of December and said, hey, what do you think about this? I wasn't sure putting my name on there. I wasn't sure if I should do that or not. But I wanted to brand myself, you know, working for 8 years at the museum and pouring my heart and soul into that place. Did a lot of great for the community. But since, you know, leaving, I wanted to, you know, why not work for myself and, build up my own brand and, you know, do that. And so I, you know, came up with this Facebook page and, you know, we're 3 months later and we're at, you know, 4,200. And by the end of the month, I should be at 5,000 if things go the way they have been, which just blows me away.
It's fantastic. Well, I mean, you'll probably pick up, you know, fives of people after this podcast. My God.
I'm at least.
So how do you decide what you're going to post? Because I'm just scrolling through because I feel like it's just always something. I got last month, I got quite an education about Betsy, the huge lobster in Isle Mirada that I did not know, but I did, let me just side note, I do remember it being on the other side of the street. So I know I'm not crazy. So we went from that to a few days ago, you had an old, wildly inaccurate, I assume, aid to navigation map of the Keys. How do you decide what you're going to post? I mean, this is now there's some pressure. People expect things.
Well, you know, I've been writing a column. I've been writing a column on Keys history in the in local papers for, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, for 10 years. So I started in 2012 with my first column with the Reporter, and I just have so much information and so much material that I've collected over the last decade. And I don't know what, you know, I wake up in the morning and, you know, first thing I do is I sit at my computer, pour myself a cup of coffee, sit at the computer and kind of go through old columns and pictures and just kind of see what strikes my fancy for the day and see what happens. And so I try to cover all the Keys. One of the aggravating things about the Florida Keys is that when people come down here, even if they're in Marathon or if they're in Isle Mirada or Key Largo, and especially when I was still waiting on tables, you know, hey, where are you guys going? Oh, we're going to the Keys. You've been in the Keys for 2 hours, sir. You know, Key West is not the Keys. You know, it's Key West is part of the Keys. It's the end of the line. And I was reading one of my guilty pleasures every morning is to go on TripAdvisor and read restaurant reviews from some of the local restaurants.
This is fascinating to me.
And it's and my favorite one.
Hobby.
Yeah, my favorite one is no longer there because the manager I only imagine got fired for posting these horrible customer responses to customer reviews, but I find that wildly entertaining. But I've talked about a local restaurant in Isle Mirada, how it's the best seafood in Key West. And that is just typical. And it's located,
what is?
You know, Lazy Days, best seafood in Key West.
But it's not in Key West.
Exactly. Which is
Lazy Days is lovely seafood. I was just there last month, but it's in Isle Mirada.
Exactly. But this is my whole point about people think that the Keys are only Key West. And so I try to, and there's, you know, and granted Key West is the hub. It's the mecca of Florida Keys history. And it's, you know, it's the, you know, primary, it's the largest community. It's the oldest community. And there is a ton of history down there, but there is so much great history up and down the Florida Keys. So I try to, you know, not concentrate so much on Key West. Although I do a lot. Yesterday I did a post about the southernmost point.
I saw that with the turtle shells.
Yes. And the really cool groovy clothes that the couple are wearing from the, it's gotta be late 60s, early 70s.
Reminds me of
Greg Brady on the Brady Bunch, Greg and Marsha Brady, you know, that's kind of their
yes.
outfits. And, but I try to, you know, tell history from up and down the Florida chain. And, you know, I do talk a lot about Key West because there's one thing I've learned in my years of, you know, studying the Florida Keys is you really can't tell a Key West story or an Isle Mirada story or a Marathon story or a Key Largo story without encompassing a greater story that is the Florida Keys. So all of the history is related. It's all connected. There are so many conduits and, you know, through up and down the island chain that it really is one large community with, you know, so they're all connected, and which is one of the things I've been trying to do is just kind of show, because all the posts aren't just about one subject. They're always, you know, generally there's some link to another island or another community.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. You say they're all one community, because I see each section of the Keys as a very different type of thing. So
I definitely, but once you you know, after, you know, more than a decade of, you know, really digging in and Florida Keys history has been my, you know, my job for, you know, it's what I do every day for 10 years or more than 10 years, really. The families, the names, it's all one. Every time I tell a Key West story, it's always, or an Isle of Marotta story, it always begins in Key West, or always, you know, everyone moves, but there's the family roots are up and down the island chain. So there really are, as far as communities, as far as people are concerned, and how these communities originally grew up, they really are all connected.
Okay. I
hear what you're saying, because Big Pine is so different than Isle of Marotta, and Key Largo and Marathon are super different.
Right. Like, so I see no difference between Summerlin Key and Key Largo. I mean, no similarities, but I get what you're saying about the through lines in the community, that the families and things like that, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. You know, the foundations, you know, the foundations are real, are fairly consistent, but you know, what kind of grew from those foundations, wildly different. I totally agree with you there, but at the base, there really is a real consistency to all the stories. In my opinion.
Give me an example.
Indian Key, as you know, my favorite story of all time, my favorite island in the Florida Keys, which is much, once upon a time, was the most important island in the Florida Keys, not named U.S. Great hidden, you know, great overlooked piece of history. If I ever talk about Indian Key, there's always a Key West part of the story. And to put that further, you know, because people, you know, originally it's connected to somehow connected, the history is somehow connected to Key West. But in the same light, when we're talking about Indian Key, then all of Upper Key's history starts at Indian Key. So if I'm talking about a pioneer family, let's say the Pinders, who were the second family to homestead on Upper Matecumbe Key, originally, you know, they were also on Indian Key, and then, you know, but if you go back further, before they were on Indian Key, they were in Key West, and those families and their, you know, their family trees are still, you know, up and down, are still, their names are everywhere, and you can't, you know, tell a story, you can't tell a Pinder story or a Russell story or an Albury story without touching on all these little islands. And from those families, you know, it comes the history, comes the farming, comes the industry, comes the, you know, the teachers and the schools and all of that.
Okay. You've made your point. I stand or sit corrected.
it's just something that I couldn't appreciate 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but I can appreciate now because one of the cool things is about looking at the history and looking at old books is now all the pieces make sense. Oh, that's where that name came from. Oh, that. Okay. So, you know, the more you study, the more I learn, the less I know, obviously, because there's so much to learn but everything makes more sense because, okay, that's what, that family came from the Bahamas. They went to Key West, then they went to Marathon, then they went to Indian Key, then they went to, you know, to Key Largo or Isle of Marotta or, you know, Upper Matecumbe. So it's really, so again, it's all one giant, you know, community with very different, let's call the kids all grew up to be very different kids.
That's fair enough. Some of the Keys are spoiled little children.
Like some of them, some of them are running
during spring break.
To be avoided at all costs.
No, so I led a trip down to Key to the Keys, as you know, early week of February, and we started in Key West, and then we moved up to Isle of Marotta because there were a lot of people who had never been to any key other than Key West. And it was an eye-opener for them. And it was great. I mean, they saw a very different side of Key West than they had seen when they were there on their trip. But then we went up to Alamorada and it was a totally different experience and they loved it. But then when we went back to Key West at the end of the week, it was insane. And it must have been some kind of switch that flipped with the seasons or something, because it was super crowded and ridiculous. And I was just wondering, when did that start with the changes with the WPA when they made it into a tourist town? Or when did Key West go from mildly popular to these fits and spurts of $800 hotel rooms and not the good hotels?
Not the good hotels. Well, that's the rise in prices has become extreme in the last couple of years, last 5 years, last 10 years, to be certain. You know, with the WPA, their goal was to make Key West a tourist destination because the train train wasn't doing its job. And so they wanted to, you know, and the highway was, you know, in 1928 was incomplete and it wasn't bringing the throngs of people they'd hoped it would. So the WPA, one of the projects was to, you know, create a series of automobile bridges that would eliminate this car ferry that was not very effective and kind of, you know, open up a continuous conduit from the mainland to Key West to bring, you know, to make it more accessible, to bring more people down. And it really, you know, after World War II is kind of when things really started to pick up. A lot of the veterans or people who were on leave would stay in Fort Lauderdale and Miami and come down to Key West and, or the Florida Keys. And that is when a big influx of like the new wave of fishing guides, because, you know, fishing is kind of how the tourism started back in, you know, in the 40s and 50s. That was the big draw, and still is today. I mean, that's never changed. But that was, you know, kind of the beginnings of the tourism of really, you know, kind of really growing. And then the 70s, you know, the 60s and 70s, Key West was the destination. The Florida Keys were really a sleepy place. And then it was just, as all things, most things in Florida, you know, it's the seasonal. It's you know, the snowbirds coming down, you know, traditionally between Valentine's Day and Easter, you know, it's really high season.
That's season where we are too, the Gulf Coast, the Central Gulf Coast. Yeah. It's like a switch. Yeah.
Yeah. All of that. That's all of Florida. And then it just kind of grew into, you know, becoming more, you know, the season, you know, growing longer. And with the Tourist Development Council, their job, you know, is to put heads on beds. And so they start creating all these festivals and things to draw people down. Fantasy Fest, you know, is in October, which is traditionally one of the slowest months, but that was something to bring people down. You know, Mini Lobster Season, you know, which is in July, traditionally a slow time, you know, or 10 years ago was a slow time. Something to bring, you know, people down to the Keys and put heads on beds and, you know, and bring in those tourist dollars. So the county did a lot of work on developing and creating, you know, I would call it a mess today because the traffic is ridiculous and you really can't enjoy it. I mean, you go to restaurants and it's crowded and, everyone's a little bit harried and
it must really be awful for you living down there. I really, really, my heart breaks for you living in the Keys and having to deal with all these horrible things. What's the temperature down there today, by the way, Brad?
It's like about a 75, 76.
It was chilly. That's chilly. Yeah,
it was raining earlier, but it's nice and blue today. if you have to, the nice thing about Key West is you park your car and you're done. That is the beauty. That's my favorite part of Key West.
And how much does it cost a day, though, to park your car?
There are a few. When I first started going down there 20 years ago, there were places that you could stay. There were secret places where you could put your car and not worry about it. Now it's, you know, $20 for the day, if you're lucky. There are some places that you can still, you know, put your car if you're not a resident.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail you. I apologize.
No. that's it all comes back to the same thing where, you know, the, everything grow and parking is one of the things that, you know, there's fewer places to park. And so people can charge 25 or 30 bucks for a parking lot, you know, for the day. And then my wife and I love to go to Key West, but it's too damn expensive. I mean, even, you know, it's 400 bucks, 500 bucks a night. And, you know, it's a special occasion.
I know what historians make. You don't have to elaborate.
In the last couple of years, it's gotten very ridiculous because we used to go down, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, 5 times a year down to Key West and stay at our favorite place. And now, you know, now it's birthdays and anniversaries, you know, when we save up and can afford to go.
Just like the rest of the country.
Just like the rest of the country.
So you mentioned something, and you'll laugh. This idea of having festivals to bring in people when it's not crowded. You know who else did that? Walt Disney World.
All right.
That was the Food and Wine Festival they have was at Epcot was designed for the fall when they're typically not busy to get people to come into the park. And there's probably no coincidence that that coincides with Fantasy Fest.
Yes. Well, that's one of the things that, and Disney Orlando plays a huge role in all of Florida tourism, not just in Orlando, but in the Keys, because, you know, a lot of the Europeans come and they spend a week at Orlando at Disney and then a week at, you know, Captiva, Sanibel and the Keys or Fort Lauderdale or what other part of the Keys, you know, they're coming to. But, you know, the Big Mouse in Orlando is you know, the primary draw probably in all of Florida. And that really does bring a huge European crowd down because they spend a couple of weeks and they spend 1 week up there and then they spend another week or however long, you know, exploring the rest of the state. And a lot of that comes down, you know, having been in Fort Myers and Cape Coral and Sanibel Captiva, you know, huge European crowd there in the summertime. In the winter and also summer, mostly summertime is mostly in state, you know, kind of more domestic. But
these people who drift in and out of the Keys, do you see a lot of them on your Facebook group? It seems like it's a lot of locals.
You know, I recognize a lot of names on, you know, but I don't recognize a lot of names. That's a lie. I don't recognize a lot of names.
Certainly you don't know everybody in the Keys.
No. But a lot of people, I'm amazed at how many people are from out of state have become members. Lots of people in the Keys. And I do look at profiles, you know, just to see kind of where people are coming from. And, but one of the cool things I really wasn't expecting, was that someone comes, you know, someone signs up or joins the group. And then all of a sudden I see they've invited 20 of their friends from all over the country.
So can you tell when people, invite people?
Yeah. As the administrator of the page, you know, it says invited by. So I can see it as they sign up. So I, you know, so there, and apparently there are different badges. I haven't not really explored in Facebook off, you know, these groups, and people who invite a lot of people get a certain badge.
Really?
Yeah. So, and there's little emblems beside some of their names, you know, like top fans or top people who've come a lot or people who've invited most people, like the first 50 people are in the group have this different kind of badge.
Yes. I've seen. All right. So you're really getting into this whole Facebook currency. It freaks me out a little bit, but
and one of the nights after I left my job, which was a bittersweet decision to make, which you know the history of, which I will not get into.
Yeah, we don't want to do that on the podcast. I need to go to that.
But after, you know, this was, you know, creating this Facebook page really helped to ground me and kind of gave me, so it's something, you know, I'm, you know, kind of in a freelance world right now. So I'm, you know, kind of a freelance historian and doing talks and things, but this kind of, this is my job. Now this has become my job and so I tend to it every day and it kind of, you know, helps ground me and helps get me going and gives me something to, you know, kind of gets me something to start with. So I'm really thankful that, you know, that I did it and I'm shocked and thrilled with, you know, how rapidly it's grown, but it really has become, you know, it's become part of my job. And I that's how I look at it, and that's how I treat it. And so I'm, you know, on it all, you know, off and on all day long, answering questions and you know, kind of steering things, make sure they don't get derailed and things don't get political. I, you know, I tend to nip those things right in the bud as soon as possible. And because
of course they do. It's Facebook. It's a dumpster fire if you're not careful. But it's still like a little, it's like a history lesson every day. I could have had a dozen people on here who have Florida Facebook groups, but what I love, it's like I wake up or whenever I circle back to it once a day, because I try and limit myself because, you know, I have shit to do.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like I'm getting a little history class. It's very drops of education.
And that's what people come up to me, you know, and say, oh, you know, your page is awesome because it is short. It's sweet. It's, you get a little piece of history, but you're not there all, you know, it's not like a 45-minute read. It's, you know, it's a two to five minute read. You know, on Sundays, I post one of my columns every Sunday. I've kind of gotten into routine. So that's a longer post, but it's 45 seconds, you know, maybe a minute to get a piece of history that you might not otherwise ever, you know, come across.
No, it's cool. I mean, do you want to say you posted today about Sombrero Light?
Uh-huh.
And I was just there, snorkeling there this last month. You should post a then and now picture so people get a sense of what it looks like, because the picture you posted, it looks like it's incredibly low tide.
Well, that's part of the post because it's called Sombrero Key Lighthouse for a reason, because it was, you know, the easternmost key in the Florida Keys for a while, or, you know, it's considered that. And it's also called Dry Bank because it was, and I use that picture for a reason, because it does show, and the description, you know, from 1828 talks about, you know, it being, you know, it being considered a key, you know, a little island out there. And that's, you know, there are several islands that pop up. I did a column called Washed Away, talking about islands that no longer exist. Lou Key, which is another fantastic place to snorkel, used to be an island out there about 200 yards by 100 yards long. Alligator Lighthouse, which is another, you know, really iconic lighthouse in the Keys. There used to be a reef or an island out there called Alligator Key. But some of these were, you know, over time and hurricanes and things, you know, kind of washed away the base. So the islands have disappeared. But, you know, there are more islands, there are more keys than just those that are connected by the lovely overseas highway. Hundreds and hundreds.
Yes. And they have the best names. While we're talking history, before we finish up, I do have one more question. I've always wanted to know this, and if you don't know it, nobody does. How did Dildo Key get its name?
Dildo Key is from a cactus called the Dildo Cactus.
That sounds wildly uncomfortable.
Yes. And I actually, I did a whole, in my column, I did that, I think, last year. And I'm working on a book right now. Kind of a compilation of many of my columns, and kind of this goes back to why I started this Facebook page, you know, Florida Keys History with Brad Bertelli, and, you know, how do I, you know, kind of move this forward. So I'm working on a book called Florida Keys History with Brad Bertelli, Volume 1, and it's kind of a collection of some of my columns that I'm kind of reworking to tell you know, these larger stories, or connecting three or four columns and kind of putting them together. But the one I'm working on right now is key names, and Dildo Key is one of those, which is why I know for a fact that it's from the Dildo Cactus.
I'm right now Googling the Dildo Cactus because some results may be explicit. Okay.
Yes.
But why? Right. So I'm looking at a picture of this, and that isn't what, that's not an actual. Okay. So,
that's not a cactus, Kathy.
No, that's not a cactus. There's some definite, there's some mixed results here, but, if you look at the Dildo Cactus, it doesn't look anything like the key unless you're looking at it top down. How?
All right. Let me let me scroll through really quick. all right. It's a night blooming cactus called Cerris pentagonus. They are called dildo cactus. That it's a climbing cactus that's found on that island. It produces these small red fruits that are related to dragon fruit. So they're edible.
Okay.
Also called strawberry pear. But it is actually a kind of cactus that happens to be prolific on that island. And, you know, and there are lots of cactus that are native to the Florida Keys, which is weird because you think of cactus as more of a Southwest, as more of an arid place. But in the subtropics, there are cactus, and this, and the dildo, the dildo cactus is one of those cactuses that are prominent in the Florida Keys, and that island happened to have a lot of them on there. Geiger Key Fish Camp. I know you've been there.
Yes, it's delicious.
Okay, same concept. Geiger Key was named because there was a proliferation of Geiger trees on the island.
Oh, see, I thought it was for the Geiger family.
Well, that is my column that comes out Thursday. I talk a lot about John Geiger. And Audubon named the Geiger tree after the wrecker John Geiger, who he had met while he was in Key West in 1832. So yes, Geiger the wrecker also, but there was, I think there was a beautiful, the Geiger tree has this really beautiful bright orange flowers on it. And Audubon liked that orange flower, found one in Geiger's garden and named it the Geiger tree in his honor.
Okay.
And then there was lots. And then later on, when people were naming, keys and the names come from all different areas for different reasons. For instance, there's a key called Manatee Key out in the upper keys off of Isla Mirada, in the Isla Mirada area, as a matter of fact. And Charles Brookfield, who named that island, that key, Manatee Key, you would think it would be for those lovely state mammals, state sea mammals. Is that the state sea mammal? Is it the state marine mammal? It could be.
Yeah, I mean, we have a habit of not wanting to offend anybody, so we'll come up with different designations. It is the state marine mammal.
All right. Since
1975.
But Brookfield named the island Manatee Key after his boat called the Manatee, and not because. So people, Bottle Cap Key, because there's an island called Bottle Cap Key, because it's shaped like a bottle. So people are looking for reasons to name things, and there was Geiger Key. There was lots of Geiger trees on there, so they called it Geiger Tree. And Dildo Key, there was lots of dildo cactus on there, so they called it Dildo Key. Although there are many, as you found out when you Googled that name, many variations.
If you could call it that.
So. Yes, but there's also an island up in the Everglades called the Dump Keys.
Dump. Okay.
And, the local fishermen call it shit keys for a reason, because that's kind of like their place to stop when they're out fishing in the Everglades. So all kinds of reasons for these names, some of them
so
more colorful,
the environment.
Some more colorful than others.
All righty. Well, on that
colorful
note and also possibly a note that gets this podcast an explicit rating. I'm not sure. I don't think so. Dildo's not a bad word.
We're talking island names here.
Island names, not anything else. On that note, I'm going to thank you so much for your time and hope to see you in person, if not back on the podcast very soon.
Excellent. Always a pleasure to be on, Kathy. Thanks so much. Always nice to talk to you. And I look forward to our next beer.
Yes,
and chit-chat.
Chit-chat, yes. And God knows what we'll talk about then. Right. Folks, we have a link to Brad's most recent book, his website, and of course his Facebook group, Florida Keys History with Brad Bertelli, in the show notes. So go there if you can't find any of those things. And I've been your host, Kathy Celestri. We'll see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.